is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I didn't know Jim in grade school. So of course, you know, when you merge into one high school, then you kind of meet everybody. And I just remember kind of one of the first games in the gym as we're getting together with different schools and learning to play with each other and so forth. That, you know, this guy, you know, he posted me up. He had spun on me so quickly and laid it in. I didn't know what happened. And, you know, I felt like I was pretty good. And, you know, he just left me in the dust. I'm like, wow, this guy can play. I wonder who this is. Yeah, it was fun to play with him, you know, both high school and college.
Jack Zimmerman is a former player at the University of Dayton from 1976 to 1980, where he scored 1,482 points and teamed up with his high school teammate Jim Paxson for the Flyers. Zimmerman played overseas for four seasons with Maccabi Tel Aviv and Hapoel Tel Aviv. Jack eventually settled in Paris, where he's lived for 30 years. He currently works for Global Data. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Kyle Cavanaugh from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Grab your notebook as you listen to this episode with Jack Zimmerman, former player for the University of Dayton and Maccabi Tel Aviv. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to be joined by former professional player, former University of Dayton basketball player, Jack Zimmerman. Jack, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Jason. Good to be here. Nice to hear your voices.
Absolutely. We are excited to have you on and looking forward to diving into the things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball life. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about what you remember, your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, I think, you know, my parents exposed me to lots of sports. So I played, the three majors at the time, which was basketball, football, baseball. You know, I was on the swimming team. I played golf with my dad, so I was pretty active as a kid. But I always liked the round ball. I always liked the ability to go out and at any time pick up a ball and just shoot. And also, it was a nice kind of gathering place for friends in the neighborhood. So I found it both socially fun, but also you could sneak off individually and just have fun and shoot all the time. And that's kind of what I did. So I guess it was, you know, early grade school, I was, you know, quite involved in all the CYO leagues and things like that. I think it was probably around 7th or 8th grade where I kind of shifted all my focus into hoops. And that became just a passion.
What was the summer basketball scene like for you growing up in Dayton, going and playing in the parks and just pickup games? And obviously the situation that we have today with youth basketball is completely different from the way that you grew up in the game or the way I grew up in the game. And it's always, I think, an interesting point of conversation that I like to talk with people who are a little bit older like me that grew up in a different era. So just talk a little bit about what the playground basketball scene was like, the pickup basketball in Dayton.
Well, you know, we were in suburbia Dayton, so it was mostly, you know, our neighborhood friends. Walking distance was kind of one set of pickup games, and that happened almost every day after school, and could go, you know, deep into the evening. And then we'd also have kind of cross neighborhoods where we had friends in other neighborhoods. So we, you know, kind of take our gang, our parents would drive us to another neighborhood and play with, you know, us against them or mix up the teams or whatever. I guess in high school, there started to be more organized playground games at some of the local high schools, at some of the outdoor, outdoor venues and so forth. But it wasn't not anything. It was still pickup games. You know, if you won, you stayed. If you lost, you're out, and you may not get back in. So the games were pretty, you know, pretty brutal. And you know, you earn your way up the chart to get picked into play. So when you're starting out, God, you know, you're picking all the best players and hoping you stay on.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, yeah. It's funny that we have. With AAU now, obviously you play, you go here, you lose, you go and play over there. And it's just a different way of growing up in the game. And I think there are, as we've said many times, there are a lot of positives to the system that we have today. And yet I say all the time that I'm really glad that I grew up in the era of pickup basketball. And I think it made me a better player. And I also think it made me a better person in a lot of ways, just for having to deal with all different kinds of people and have to figure out how to stand up for yourself and call winners and pick a team or negotiate and all the things that kind of went along with playing in the park. And I really feel like that had a big influence on me. When you think about yourself as a high school player, was there anybody that you kind of looked up to as a mentor or somebody who kind of took you under their wing as a player in that era that kind of looked out for you? Was there anybody that fits that bill?
Well, I had great coaches, starting with my dad, my uncle, who kind of coached myself and my brother and our kids' teams in grade school. And then had a kind of a basket case coach my freshman year. But then sophomore, I mean, all through the rest of my career, these guys are outstanding, you know, Hall of Fame type coaches. Joe Petroselli, at Kettering Alter High School, but before him, Jim Seawee, who was kind of a legendary football coach, but you know, just good people that taught great discipline, and had they would just make sure that you were doing the right things, and you know, it just continued on into all of my career. So I guess those guys were the mentors. Of course, I always looked up to. Like Don Donaher at the University of Dayton. You know, I was in high school, but they were the, you know, the big college basketball team in town. And of course I liked, like Walt Frazier. And of course I looked into the NBA and watched some of the great players over there, but I did like, Clyde was a guy I loved to watch.
Yeah. Very fun. I mean, when you think about Clyde Frazier and the sort of the fashion and him as a player and just the smoothness, with which he played made him, I think, unique in his time and probably unique all time. When you start talking about guys that he in this era would have been a fashion icon without question. Not that he wasn't back in the day, but
hey, Mike,
when you think about social media,
the NBA draft tonight, Mike, did you see that one sent you?
Well, I don't know what you sent me, but Grady Dick's
Did you see that?
Yeah, he was shining in red.
Yeah. Oh God, it's god awful.
Scoots was pretty good. I think I what's funny to me is that these guys don't necessarily learn the lesson of guys in the past. That I think, look, I know they want to be a little flashy, but those suits are not going to age well 20 years from now. I think I'd go a little bit more traditional, just so I could kind of. I like what the Thompson twins were wearing. They seemed like they had some at least semi-normal conservative outfits on, but
well,
who knows?
Going traditional certainly would have stood out in tonight's draft. But also, you know, in my era, of course, you know, even though I did, you know, I admired Clyde and the way he played. And of course, my brother was a big Earl of Pearl fan. And my best friend was a Jerry West fan. And, you know, Tim Gallagher, you know, he was a Brian Winters fan. So we all had our kind of favorites. But I don't think any of us were really fashion standouts ourselves in our local neighborhood.
I can attest to that for myself as well. I don't think that I wasn't winning any fashion awards, so I guess I don't have much room to talk about.
Yeah, well, your shoes though now, Mike. Your shoes are pretty.
Yeah, I guess I do have. I guess I do like. I do like to go flashy with the shoes and the socks. That's where I'll put my fashion foot forward, so to speak. So, but yeah, I'm not much in the way of putting on a suit if I can avoid it. Let's put it that way. So talk a little about that childhood friend group that you had. And I know that, you know, Tim's obviously talked about, and for those people who are listening, Tim Gallagher is a guest on the podcast. And I got introduced to Tim through Kim Otten, who I know from here in Strongsville. And Kim obviously was part of that, you know, that group back then. And it's just interesting how you guys all kind of came together. And then you had some good stories with card collecting and the different things that Tim eventually got into. But talk about what it was like with that particular friend group and just kind of how you guys bonded together.
Yeah, I mean, we were just, we're buddies from kind of from second grade, and we all had this passion for basketball, also for, autograph collecting, and kind of in my local neighborhood, walking distance, you know, we had kind of Vince and Steve Martin, which are brothers. We had myself and my brother Mike, and there were a couple other friends in the area. Tim lived up closer to the grade school that we went to, and Kim Otten, of course, and there's kind of a neighborhood of kids there. So when I talked about the cross neighborhood, you know, we'd bring our Washington Township team over to play the Centerville team and have some real battles. But what was just so nice about it is that, you know, we'd play game after game after game. And of course, you know, it was super, super competitive. But when we finished, we'd walk up to the local Poor Richards, you know, kind of like Dairy Queen place, would have a, you know, ice cream and a slush and sit around and just talk more about life and basketball and so forth that you would as a kid, right? So you would be really super competitive, but then, you know, at the end you just kind of go off what a kid would do and just hang out and have fun. So yeah, it was beautiful, and we all loved to play, and we loved to play, I think, the right way. You know, a lot of kind of passing and picking and cutting, and it was not that much one-on-one. Of course, we were playing on confined courts. You know, these are driveways. And so some driveways were really long and thin. Some were kind of wide and short. And so you developed your game also along the kind of the confines of whatever you were playing in.
When did you know that you wanted to play college basketball? Was that something that, because you kind of grew up very close proximity to University of Dayton basketball, that was kind of always on your radar? Or was it something that you came to realize as you got more into your high school career?
I think, of course, you know, I was inspired by the University of Dayton and watching some of the legendary games there. And it was, you know, it just consumes the town, which was great. I also went to, you know, basketball camps. I went to Coach Donaher's camp, Don Donaher. I went to Bobby Knight's camp. I went to Bill Hoskett's camp in Ohio State. So I went to a number of camps and started to, you know, realize that, you know, I could play with most people. And I think it was probably between eighth grade is kind of when I started to decide that this is really what I like to do. And I think it was between eighth and ninth grade where I started to really sharpen my skills. And I think, you know, the main story that really got me to another level is my freshman year in high school. You know, we were a white Catholic basketball neighborhood, and we went over and played an African-American kind of west side of Dayton team. And I couldn't get the ball up the court. I mean, they must have stole the ball from me seven times before I even got it up, up to half court. And I was a freshman. And it just dawned on me that if I don't sharpen my skills, let's say how to handle the, you know, ball control, just basketball dribbling drills and things like that, you know, I'm not going to progress, and that I had a lot of work to do. And from that period on, I just started to accelerate, and I did it in a very kind of structured way.
What was that structure? So how did you go about, once you realize you're like, hey, I got to get better if I kind of want to do the things in this game that I'd like to do? What did that process look like for you? How did you structure it?
I would get up, I'd go to the local YMCA, or I'd go out on, you know, on my own driveway. And I would build kind of my practice for the day, but it wasn't like for the day. It was like, I mean, it was for the day, you know, it wasn't like an hour, and it was drills. It was ball handling drills. It was shooting drills. It was pretend, you know, that I was in March Madness and I was, you know, I'd build my own lottery and I'd pick teams. And then I'd be both teams. Right. And so I'd create my own kind of fantasy around games and so forth. And I'd track all of that, you know, I'd put it on paper and, you know, I just did all the things that I felt that I needed to work on. One of the regrets, I guess, I have is maybe not investing enough in the athleticism. So if I would do it over again as a kid, I would probably learn how to run better, jump higher, you know, be more limber and stretch. I mean, I put more effort into the physical part of it. But at that time, it was really just about the joy of playing and just working on all the aspects of the game.
Yeah. I mean, completely different era when you think about athleticism, right?
Mm.
You look at the players who were playing in the NBA or playing college basketball, and you look at their physique compared to the physiques of players who are playing in the league today. I remember this stood out for me. I can't remember exactly when I saw this photo, but it was probably, I don't know, within the last 5 or 6 years, I saw a picture of like Doug Collins from his rookie year after he was the number one pick out of Illinois State. And Doug Collins, seriously, his body looked like he could have been a freshman in high school today. And you're looking at him and you're saying, this guy was the number one pick. And he just, again, he wasn't muscular. He wasn't big. He just looked like a skinny little kid. And today, obviously, it would be far, far different. Somebody who reached the level of basketball that you were able to reach, which we'll eventually get to here, was going to put a lot more time into their body today than somebody back at that time. Because it just wasn't something that, I mean, I think I was sort of at the beginning of, my dad was an exercise physiologist at Cleveland State. So he had me doing like lots of plyometrics and weird stuff. I always say I couldn't jump no matter what I did, but maybe the plyometrics really did work and I could only jump like 3 inches off the ground if I hadn't done them. But it certainly did not turn me into a plus athlete, all the work that I did on that. But it was a completely different era compared to today when you have kids that are going out and working with trainers, both on their basketball skill, but the athleticism side of that is, I think that business has exploded. And one of my theories about that is that kids just don't play outside. So like you and I learned to run by running and running away from people and chasing people and doing all those things. And then I heard an interesting theory today, Jack. Let me hear. I'd be curious to know what you think. And Jason, you could maybe even jump in on this. But I was talking to Mark Anderson, who he coaches in the TBL for the Owensboro Thoroughbreds. And he's working at basketball camp with me this week. And he said that one of the things that someone told him, like a medical professional that kind of works with their league, is that he thinks that you get way more hamstring injuries today than people used to get back in the day because nobody's riding their bikes. Like kids don't grow up riding their bikes the way you or I did. And so therefore their hamstrings are weaker than kids' hamstrings used to be in the past. And obviously as you grow up, you just don't develop that same strength. And he thinks that's maybe led to more hamstring injuries, which I had never heard that before. And I thought that was kind of an interesting theory.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. I mean, certainly it just wasn't that much consciousness on the body that much until you realize, you know, you wanted to jump higher and then you do things like, you know, we tried the leaper and we tried all kinds of things.
Spent a lot of time on that machine.
I was just going to say, I don't really see like a lot of hamstring injuries, but I coach middle school basketball, so it might be a little bit different. Like, I don't know. I don't remember.
I think they're talking about like as you get – I think he was talking about more as you get into like college and pro basketball that it's sort of a trickle down. Again, I don't even know if the theory's right, but I just found it to be interesting. It was something that I had never heard before.
Hmm. Yeah, I would have definitely spent much more time. I really learned a lot when I got invited to try out for the Blazers. Jack Ramsey was the head coach and Jim Lynham was the assistant coach. Again, two stellar people, you know, legends in their own right. But Jack Ramsey was a big physical fitness, you know, advocates. So, I mean, we, before practice, we would be jumping rope and we'd be doing lots of stretching and kind of yoga stretching and all of that. And again, it was one of the first times I kind of woke up and said, man, you know, it is about your body getting your body tuned. It's not just about the kind of the slide drills and the sprint drills and things like that. You need to do other things to get your body ready. And, you know, when I grew up, there were rumors like Kentucky was a big, you know, weightlifting team for basketball. But, you know, we were always told don't lift weights, you know, it's going to screw up your shot and things like that. So we were late to that part of the game, really, the physical part.
What about on the nutrition side? Did you think at all about the things that you were eating back then?
Nothing. No, absolutely. Zero.
I'm right there with you. I often look and I think about, and I've told this story a couple of times, but when I was playing at Kent, we used to, in the preseason, we would have practice, whatever, all during the week. And then on Saturday in the preseason, we'd have like an inter-squad scrimmage to go along with our practice. And it would go from like 7 to 10:30, let's say, on Saturday morning. And then we would have Sunday off and wouldn't practice until Monday. And literally, we would leave practice at 10:30, whatever, take a shower, and we'd go right to Ponderosa. And then we'd sit in Ponderosa for like 3 hours and probably drink a gallon of soda and eat chicken wings and steak and greasy spaghetti and all this stuff. And just, you know, college student, it was whatever, the $9 buffet. And, you know, you just think about, God, what if I was actually eating well while I was in college? And somebody had told me like, hey, maybe you should lay off of this, or maybe you should eat a little bit more of that. And to your point, I spent zero, never once ever did I have a conversation with any adult coach, nutritionist, strength coach about any of that stuff. And certainly I didn't think about it in any way.
No, I mean, we, you know, we live near at UD, University of Dayton, we live near kind of a Frisch's Big Boy. So, you know, it was two big boys and fries and a milkshake, you know, on a regular basis. So, you know, there you go. It wasn't, it just wasn't part of the regime at the time.
Absolutely not. What's your favorite memory from being a high school basketball player?
I think, you know, we had some tremendous local high school rivals against teams like Fairmont West, against teams like Roosevelt and Dunbar and so forth. So we would fill, you know, the UD arena or pretty close to fill the arena, and kind of one half would be in purple and the other half would be in, you know, in black and gold, or one half would be in, you know, in red, and the other half would be in gold and brown. I mean, so you'd have these incredible, really high intense, very close games, lots of skilled players. And so I remember that a lot. I also remember kind of, you know, we knocked off some great teams on the way to the state. We lost in the state semifinal. We got knocked off. We were upset in the semis, as was Phil Hubbard's team. You know, we were the kind of the number one and two teams were supposed to meet each other. But we did knock off Middletown that had Butch Carter. We did knock off, Roosevelt, that had, just loaded with talent, but we lost. So, you know, when you lose, your second or third place doesn't get remembered very well.
Only by you, right? Only the losses stick with you than anything else. I say that all the time. Like, those losses, you can win a lot of games, but man, the losses, I'll never forget. And I've told the story. I'm not even going to bother telling it again, but we lost in we lost in the district semifinal. So Lorraine Admiral King, who ended up going all the way to they lost, I think, in the state semifinals. And, you know, controversial ending and a whole bunch of other things, and played against a guy that eventually became my teammate, and just the whole, and I can still remember almost everything about that game versus games that we won. It's like, I don't know. I think we won that game, but I don't really remember. Man, those losses, those losses sting, man. They sting.
They do. And we were a powerhouse in high school. I mean, we just rolled teams, and we had three Division I players, four actually Division I players, and then a fifth that could have easily played Division I. And, you know, we full court pressed, we ran. I mean, we were just really, really good. And so it was fun also. I mean, what I liked about it was just we were a team. I mean, we passed the ball, and it was great. We were, you know, great coach, and Yeah, it was a good time.
When your team shares the ball, there's nothing better.
Yeah, I mean, that's it.
I think from a fan standpoint, certainly from a coaching standpoint, and more than anything else, from a playing standpoint, when you play on a team that's unselfish, you play with unselfish guys, it's just more fun. And let's face it, you're going to win more. I mean, I think it's the Nuggets kind of proved it a little bit this year with the way that they played. And I think you can see it year in and year out on the college basketball level, on the high school basketball level, that the teams that are unselfish and share the ball, they're so much more difficult to beat. And it's just a much more fun way to play basketball. And nobody can ever convince me otherwise.
Yeah. And I think a lot has to do with, the player, but clearly the coach, and kind of, he sets the direction. And, like I said, my coaches were great, all great mentors along the way. So I respected them. I paid attention to what they said. I listened to and tried to learn. And, they help blend good people into good teams.
What's something that you've taken away from, and you could pick any of the coaches that you've had over the years, but what's something that when you think about it in your life, you attribute it directly back to one of your coaches?
I think teamwork, and I think being disciplined, taking responsibility. Being self-motivated. I mean, there are a lot of little subtle things as well that you don't think about, but it's all kind of becomes inherent as part of the process of working with good people. And, being firm. So, knowing, you can push the line, but there are things that, you can't, you got to give up for the team, right? Or whatever.
Exactly.
Right.
And yep.
So I think there's a blend of things, and each coach is a little bit different. I mean, my coach in Tel Aviv, he spoke seven languages, and he could be quite emotional, but he also knew how to blend lots of different personalities. And as I got older, the personalities became more robust. As you get older, of course, you get your own wings, and not everybody's, kind of cookie cutter high school, Catholic, type of player. So it's really interesting. Yeah, but good coaches are really important.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I love when you said that it kind of becomes inherent, and I think that's true, that you absorb all those things, and they sort of become a part of you. Like, I look at my life and I say that basketball is just, it's a part of me, and because it's a part of me, there's all these things that I've learned along the way that just I take them for granted almost, that the reason I am the way I am is because of some of the things that I got to experience through the game of basketball, whether it was through my experiences playing pickup basketball, whether it was through my experiences with the coaches that I had at each one of my different levels. And I think you put it really well, in that you kind of learn all those things along the way, and they just sort of seep into who you are. And then eventually you look back and you're like, I really don't know or remember what I would be without the game of basketball. And it's just interesting how the influence that it has on us.
Yeah. And, I take it to my world today, which is more in kind of sales and working with customers. And, there's just so many lessons you learn about, building relationships, about being supportive, about being prepared, about being, direct, about the trying to win together. I mean, there's so many things that you, again, you're not even really thinking about, but it becomes a more second nature.
Yeah, I agree. Could not agree more with that. When you think back to your decision to go to the University of Dayton, obviously you grew up around Dayton basketball. You went to camp with Coach Donaher. So you've been around it for your entire life. Was the decision to go to the University of Dayton an easy one? Did you consider going anywhere else? Just tell me a little bit about the process of making that choice to go to Dayton to attend college and to play your college basketball.
Yeah, I think it was, in the end, it was an easy one because Coach Donaher in the program wanted me to come. It was clearly it was a class program, in a big arena, playing as an independent at the time against the best schools, around America, which was fantastic. I wasn't highly recruited. I mean, had, offers maybe from Miami and West Virginia and, the Army and kind of that tier of college. But I just was pretty zoned in on Dayton. It made sense to me. And so, when I was asked, I was pretty much ready to sign. And I'd also had, my teammate Jim Paxson had just gone there. So we'd been backcourt teammates for already a couple years, and yeah, it just felt good. And I felt like I had a chance to play. Johnny Davis, who ended up going to the Portland Trail Blazers, was going to leave on hardship hardship and go early into the NBA. And so that opened up a spot for me as well to get more playing time to earn that. So, it was a good situation for me.
Talk about the relationship that you had with Paxson and what it was like playing with him. Obviously a guy who reached a tremendously high level in the game, and not everybody gets an opportunity to play with a player like that. So what was that like for you growing up, going through high school, and then continuing on to play with him throughout your college career?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I didn't know Jim in grade school. So of course, when you kind of merge into one high school, then you kind of meet everybody. And I just remember kind of one of the first games in the gym is, we're getting together with different schools and kind of learning to play with each other and so forth. That, this guy, he posted me up, and then he had spun on me so quickly and laid it in. I didn't know what happened. And, I felt like I was pretty good. And, he just left me in the dust. I'm like, wow, this guy can play. I wonder who this is. And so, but anyway, we ended up playing, he was a year ahead of me, but we played, I was a junior, he was a senior. And then we went into high school and I started as a freshman and played all my years, my 3 years with him until he graduated. And we just had we were kind of on a string together, so I could just look we would match eyes, and he was great at backdooring his man. So he'd set up his man and do a backdoor cut, and I could put it right on the spot under the basket where he could lay it in. And it was just telepathy communication. So, and it was fun to watch him play because, we played a passing game at Dayton, which really is kind of pass and pick away. It was a Bobby Knight methodology. So we didn't really learn at Dayton to drive, to take it to the hole, but Jim had a special, so he could play that game. But when he saw an opening, he'd cut to the hole and lay it in. And, that was kind of NBA like right at the time. And he had the body to be an NBA player. He had the smarts. He was athletic and the skill sets, and it was fun to play with him, both high school and college.
I think of him the first thing I think of when I think of Jim Pax is I think of ball movement and moving without the ball and just being a guy that would have been really, really difficult to guard in the sense of, man, this guy is just not going to stop. And when I think of Jim Pax, and that's the first thing that comes into my head when I think about his game and what I knew about it.
Yeah, he was a master at that. And it wasn't herky-jerky. I mean, he wasn't just running around without purpose. He would take you out and just kind of, lull you to sleep. And then, boom, he'd be backdoor and he'd be, a layup, or he'd be cutting off picks. And you can see it in the NBA as well. He was known for that. And that's why he was a, two-time All-Star and one of the top scorers of all time in Portland, is because he could get open and get his shots. And, he wasn't super, super quick, but he was really clever and deceptively, agile, and very, very smart with and without the ball.
Talk a little about the influence of Coach Donaher and what he meant to you both as a player and as a person.
Yeah. I mean, he's, one of the great legends, both as a person and as a basketball coach. And, just growing up, knowing him, under his influence, knowing what he did for the Dayton community, putting Dayton kind of basketball on the map. And, it's just inspirational. So I still, when I'm in town, try to seem. I'm friends with the family. You just somebody you look up to. And so he's just got the respect of the whole community. And I'm one of them. I'm a disciple.
As you're going through your career at Dayton, are you focused in on, hey, I think I'm going to have a shot to have a professional career? What are you studying while you're at Dayton? What do you think you want to do with your life beyond basketball? And kind of where were you in balancing out those two in terms of pursuing maybe your dream of playing professionally versus a what career am I looking ahead to in my adult life?
Yeah, I think I was pretty all in on hoops, to be honest. I mean, I didn't think about much else most of the time. So I practiced all the time. I, you know, watched games. I'd watch film. I would, you know, I would just be, yeah, I was pretty much overcome by it. And it wasn't really until at the end of my senior year when you kind of face reality and you go, okay, now what's next? Because I didn't get drafted. I thought I would. There were kind of rumors that it could be second to seventh rounds and all of that, but I didn't get picked. So that was quite disappointing. And so then you're like, okay, what am I going to do with my life? And I still, you know, you're still young. So you're like, gosh, you know, I can still play. I want to still play. What are the avenues open to me?
And so how did you pursue that? Like, how much knowledge did you have about what might potentially be out there in terms of European basketball? Because I think now when you think about kids who graduate at all different levels, and it's not just limited to Division I, I think there's just way more opportunity to play overseas. And I also think that it's easier to get information. And I'm a few years younger than you, but I know even when I was coming out, it was kind of difficult to figure out, where do I have to go? Who do I have to talk to? Who can help me? Where should I be? Who should see me? And we didn't have the internet to be able to go and just try to figure that stuff out the way that kids do today. And I think that I'm assuming that for you, you had to find somebody who kind of could help you to navigate that. So just what did the process look like for you trying to find a home in professional basketball?
Yeah, I would say, you know, Mike, I was really lucky because, you know, basically, I guess going into my senior year, I was invited to be part of a, I think it was called the U.S. Intercontinental Cup team. It was, I think it was a FIBA-sponsored team or whatever, but it was Ed Badger from Cincinnati was the coach. We had people like Albert King and Eddie Lee and Steve Johnson from Oregon and LaVon Williams. And it was basically an all-star team. It was all pre-Olympic because the Olympics were going to be played in Moscow in the 80s. And so they were kind of looking at maybe who might make those teams. And so we went to France, we went to Yugoslavia, went to Czechoslovakia, went to Russia, Ukraine, and we played all the kind of the top international teams over there. So that was my first exposure to international basketball. We went to Tel Aviv. But I didn't really connect the dot between myself going back there and playing. You know, it was an avenue to go back and try to make the NBA. But you know, after I did not get drafted, then I had some choices to make, and the question really was, what am I going to do? And Coach Donner, you know, suggested maybe I become a grad assistant, get an MBA, and you know, hang around and do some coaching and things like that. But my uncle, who was he was a priest and also the team chaplain, had a connection with the Harlem Globetrotters, the Washington Generals. And okay. So I ended up playing 1 year with the Washington Generals against the Harlem Globetrotters for 1 year. And so that kept me in the game. And after that, I basically, you know, came back from that. And again, I'm faced with what I want to do. And then I had an invite to try out with the Blazers as a free agent. So I went out to Portland. They had 10 draft choices and 10 free agents. They, after the big last kind of red and white game, you know, full out arena, they walked in and said, okay, you're cut. You go to LA, you're cut, you go to LA. And I made the cut. So they took 10 of us to LA for a month in the summer leagues. And that's where I was discovered by, you know, an Israeli team to come over and play professional basketball. I didn't pursue it. They saw me, and apparently somebody from the Knicks had recommended me, and they knew Coach Donaher. And next thing you know, I got a call and said, how would you like to go play, you know, professional basketball in Europe in Tel Aviv? And I'm like, well, gosh, I didn't know they really played there, but if you give me a round trip ticket, I'll go over and see what it's like. And then, boy, then I'm suddenly, you know, I'm with a, you know, top six European pro basketball team playing against the best European teams in the world. So it was fascinating. Totally lucky, Mike. Totally lucky.
It's funny how that works. I mean, it really is. Sometimes you're in the right place at the right time, and it's cool that you had the Globetrotters and Generals experience. So I have experience with the Generals too. I played one game with the Generals.
No kidding.
Yeah. I won a radio contest. They had like a tryout. You had to go to this high school and they were going to pick one person from this thing to go and play for the Generals. And somebody had called me up. One of my friends said, hey, they're doing this thing. You should go do it. And I showed up and there was all different kinds of people. I mean, it was crazy. There was people who were basketball players, or people who weren't basketball players. There was guys doing like, you had to do like a 1 minute, whatever. They gave you a ball and said, okay, go do something for a minute. So I just went out and shot and just did whatever, just like I was doing a basketball workout. And then there was other people doing cartwheels and flips and all kinds of stuff. But anyway, I ended up getting selected. And so I played out at the Richfield Coliseum. I played one game with the Generals and I got into the circle where you kind of got to run behind them as they're flipping the ball around. They're like, you got to stay right on your Globetrotter's shoulder. And apparently I didn't, because I got hit in the head with the ball, but they did follow me and got me to the line. I went 2-for-2 out at the Coliseum for the,
awesome.
For the Generals.
What year was that?
So that was, oh boy, it was probably pretty shortly after I graduated from college. So I'm thinking it was probably, it had to be 93 okay. or 94, somewhere in there. Cause I guess the Cavs new arena opened in 95. So it had to be, I graduated in 92. So sometime between 92 and 94, I would guess.
Okay.
But yeah, that's kind of fun.
Yeah. That's wild. Well, my, you know, I flew to New York City, met kind of the teammates in a, you know, in a bar in New York City. We bused to Portland, Maine. We ferried over to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and that's where the tour started.
Okay.
My first game, you know, so I didn't start in my first game, and they put me in kind of midway through the first quarter. And, you know, Curley's out there dribbling the ball, and I take it from him a couple times. You know, I didn't know anything. I mean, they didn't tell me anything about how it all works and so forth. And, the third time, you know, I somehow went down and I missed a layup. And so I'm running back, you know, everybody's running back, and Curley stops the game. He just, you know, completely stops the game in front of everybody, and he kind of fingers me back to the other end of the court and he's pointing up at the hoop and he's saying, okay, you know, put it in the basket. And so he gives me the ball to do it. And as I try to do that, he blocks me and, you know, he just embarrassed me
that's
completely.
Funny.
And there you
that's,
go. That was my,
funny.
My first experience.
There you go. I don't think people who, like today, if you're under the age of 40, like even Jason, I don't know how much, but you think about how impactful the Globetrotters were in an era when we were kids and ABC.
Hey, I went to the Globetrotters with my grandpa every year when I was in middle, like elementary school.
All right.
Until he passed
away. I still felt like their cultural significance had declined by the time
I used to watch the Scooby-Doo episode with the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah, all right. Okay. Man, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe their influence extended further than what I thought. So my apologies, Jay.
Now they're pretty worldwide. At least, of course, yeah, you're right. I mean, at least in my era, they left their imprint everywhere around the world.
Now, if you ask kids today, though, about who the Harlem Globetrotters are, I'm going to tell you that it's going to be way lower percentage though now.
Right? Yeah, not many. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your coaching portfolio guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. What was the coolest place you went with them, Jack?
I stayed on the kind of the North American tour. I didn't go to Europe and I didn't go to like South America. They had two teams at the time. They had one that did kind of the, you know, the East Coast, West Coast, Midwest, Canada, and they had another one that did kind of like Southwest and Latin America and so forth. So, but you know, we played all the big hockey arenas in Montreal and Toronto and things like that. We played Madison Square Garden, Boston Gardens, you know, Chicago, the LA Forum. So those were always, you know, really great experiences. And those were always doubleheaders on Sunday. So we started, gosh, I think the tour started, early September. And we played literally every day, doubleheaders on Sundays. And I think we had Thanksgiving off, Christmas off for a day or two. And then it went all the way through like the middle of May. So it was a long, you know, you'd get up at 10, you'd hop on the bus, 4-hour bus ride. New location, you go out and give your two tickets away, you know, come and play, go out at night, get up again, 10 o'clock. It was an interesting tour. And of course, we were the generals, so we stayed, you know, in the budget hotels and we had the halftime act on our bus and all of that, where the trotters stayed in the nice hotels. I mean, that was the gig, right?
Right.
But it was great. You know, the good people and, we really played serious, except for a couple of routines each quarter, where we really, you know, we were never instructed not to do anything, but you just kind of understood that you don't mess up a routine. So we were basically spotting them kind of 16 points a game,
right.
And then we would play hard, and we'd have our trash talking during the games and stuff. So
it's fun. I remember I have good memories of that experience. Like the generals guys were good to me when I was in the locker room with them and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they were all good dudes. And, you know, obviously the Globetrotters had to kind of be in on like, here's this, you know, not only are we going to the generals, but now we got to incorporate this guy, which I'm sure they were doing in other cities too. I'm sure it wasn't just my experience, but anyway, it was fun. It was definitely a fun experience. Something that I'll never remember. I still have I got to keep the uniform. So I got the general's uniform, although it was teeny tiny when they gave it to me. And I mean, now that thing's got to be, I think if I pulled it out, some fourth or fifth grader might be like, I don't even know if I want to wear that thing. It's pretty small. So, but definitely a good memory without question. Let's get back to, all right. So you finish that year with the generals, you get spotted in LA, you get a chance to go over and play in Israel, as you said, big time European basketball. And what was that like when you first get there? Like, are you overwhelmed? Does it feel comfortable? Just what was your initial reaction when you got over there to play and then also just adjust culturally and being away from home?
I arrived at the airport and they kind of whisked me past security and they were hiding me actually, which I didn't know, but because what had happened out in LA is when I was running off of the court, somebody had asked me, I think we were playing the Knicks and, you know, I was running the halftime and somebody just out of clear blue said, are you Jewish? And I'm like, I don't know. Why would you ask me that? I'm not, but my name is Imran, but I'm not Jewish. And that was it. And so, in the end, what happened is when I went to Israel, Maccabi Tel Aviv bought me, the number two team, they were afraid other people were going to, you know, find out that I was there. So they kind of whisked me and they hid me in the coach's house and so forth. So that was already kind of an experience. But what I didn't know is hadn't like made the team. You know, I thought they were bringing me over, but you know, we had kind of like a tryout. So the coach worked me out a bit and then went over and played with some of the other guys. And next thing you know, I'm signing a contract by the swimming pool, on handwritten contract and paper. So I didn't really kind of know. I was naive. I didn't know how it was all really worked, to be honest with you. What I did realize quite quickly was that this was really a big deal in this country. You know, there was one television channel on Thursday nights. It was Maccabi Tel Aviv basketball. And so, you know, I was I went out on a trip in the desert, you know, less than a week, let's say, when I was there, and people already knew me on television and things like that. It was, you know, people come up to me in the gas station and say, "Hey, welcome." So it was pretty, you know, it's like being the Lakers in LA at the time, you know, it was a big deal. And then I realized that the competition was fantastic, you know, maybe less so in the league at the time, but in the international leagues, you were playing against the Real Madrids and the top Yugoslavia teams, the Russian teams, the Italians were fantastic at the time, the Spanish, it was great.
From a cultural standpoint, did you feel comfortable right away?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I like the Israeli culture. They're very direct. So when you do something great, you know, they'll lift you on your shoulders. If you miss a shot or you screw up a game, you know, they'll, you know, "You idiot," you know, they'll slap your face. I mean, so they kind of tell you like it is. It's not like kind of "nice try," you know, go get them next time. It was like, "You idiot." So it was kind of refreshing in some ways. And I was really embraced. I also worked hard to integrate, because what I didn't do is go over there and kind of sleep all day and you know, eat and go to practice and then go out at night and do that again. You know, I got up and I learned Hebrew because I wanted to learn it. And so I just got involved with the community a little bit and built some Israeli friends and things like that. And so it also made things become, you know, much culturally much more attuned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think taking advantage of that opportunity to have it be about more than just basketball, clearly that's something that I'm sure when you look back on, you're really glad that you did. Because I'm sure there are other guys that probably didn't do that, that went to practice and took a nap and laid in their apartment and, you know, didn't get as much out of the experience as you did.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, there were a lot of political tensions at that time, Middle East political tensions. Right. So when we would travel, you know, we always had, you know, bodyguards and, you know, in the hotels at each of the hallways, security guys. And, you know, we would play in Yugoslavia and they would have, you know, Yasser Arafat posters and they'd be screaming at you and things like that. It was quite intense. It was really enriching. I mean, it was a beautiful experience.
What's your craziest European basketball story?
Oh gosh, I guess, let me think, you know, I know we played in an old kind of Olympic venue, very small arena in Greece. And one of our players, Earl Williams, who was he played in the NBA 5 years, played for five different teams, but, you know, apparently Kareem Abdul-Jabbar called him, you know, the best rebounding player he's ever played against. He's the guy. He would come to the court and he could put his chin on his knees without stretching at all. I mean, he was just flexible. He was just athletic, but he was also quite crazy. So he went after a loose ball, got the ball. The crowd was just on top of this with flares and all of these kinds of things. And he walked about 10 feet, turned around and just threw the ball at this guy, this fan, and just right in the face, and just, you know, we just had a riot that broke out. So it stopped the game for about an hour. We finished the game. We left the game on our knees on the bus, because they were rocking our bus with the curtains closed. You know, there were rumors that a couple of the LAL stewardesses were missing. I mean, those kinds of stories. There were a few of those kinds of stories.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, that's the question I love to ask anybody who was fortunate enough to play overseas. Everybody has one, if not multiple, stories of things that just, you look at it from an American sports perspective and it's hard to kind of wrap your head around some of the experiences that guys who have played overseas have had. When you think about that, the totality of your experience overseas, and getting obviously a chance to extend your career beyond the college level, as your experience in the game was starting to come to an end and you realized that, hey, maybe my playing career is going to come to a close, did you ever have any thoughts of coaching or figuring out some way to stay involved in the game as your profession? Or when it was over, were you ready for it to be over and move on to the next chapter?
Hey, that's a great question. I mean, it's hard to let go, as probably anybody in our position knows, and especially when you're still young and feel like you can play. But at some point you have to kind of rationalize everything. So it wasn't easy to stop playing. I didn't really want to be into kind of any formal coaching at a higher level. I didn't like, I'd been asked, I didn't really like the recruiting aspect. I did a lot of the recruiting at Dayton and it was great, but I didn't want to go out off and travel into people's homes and try to do that. I loved coaching kind of at the kids' level. So grade school, early high school. And so I also in Dayton, you know, during the summers would run a summer camp with, one of my ex coaches. And I love that kind of thing. So I did a little bit of that in Israel for a while, but you know, at some point I felt like I had to get, you know, into a more professional world, on a business world, and start building a different life. And so that's what I did. You know, I went back from Tel Aviv to the States and got involved in high tech in the early 80s when it was just, you know, the PC was just coming out. So I wanted to be in something kind of fast and dynamic like sports. And I wasn't an engineer and I had no tech background, but I wanted to figure out how to get into that world. And that's what I did. And so
what'd you major in college?
I majored in business and, you know, business marketing, business management, that kind of thing.
When you look back at your experiences with the game of basketball and you think about all that it's done for you, if you could boil it down to, I know we talked about this a little bit before, but if you could boil it down to maybe just one or two things that you think what basketball has given you in your life, and you could probably take this question a million different directions, but when you think about the one or two most important things that basketball has given you in your life, what are those things?
Yeah, I think, you know, knowing how to prepare, I think, you know, being disciplined, I think self-motivation, I think teamwork, those kinds of things, collaboration, I think those kinds of things are just embedded in the game. And I think I take away that. I mean, certainly my experience has shaped my life because I've ended up, living in France, and that's where I spend, you know, I've been there now 30 years. So my international experiences in basketball got me excited about, you know, seeing what it's like to live in other parts of the world. I think, you know, now when I go to business meetings, you know, I'll have around the table, you know, a Dutch person, a German person, a Spanish person, an English person, a Slav person, whatever. And so being able to excel in that kind of multicultural environment, I mean, that's certainly come from my basketball experiences over time. So all of that's contributed to kind of who I am. And it's also given me a great appreciation to travel. So I love to get out and see the world. And all of that came, ultimately from picking up that little orange ball.
It's funny, isn't it? It's crazy when you think about it. Well, since we're recording on the night of the NBA draft and we had a Frenchman go number one, give us your Victor Wembanyama take. Is he going to be the great player that everybody thinks he is? What's your 30-second evaluation of Victor?
I mean, I've seen the highlights like everybody else. I haven't gone to see him in person in France. I think clearly everybody knows he has to build out his body and get stronger. He reminds me a lot of Ralph Sampson.
He does. I agree.
And Ralph was obviously a fantastic player and, you know, an all-star and all of that. His durability didn't last as long as we had hoped. And I kind of hope that, you know, Victor can build that durability over time and just become a legend, you know, something we've never seen before in our life. And I think that's all possible from what I've just seen in the clips.
Yeah, the skill level is off the chart for a guy his size. He moves. I think Sampson is a really good comparison, because I think if Sampson were to be teleported into this era, he would have played a lot like Wembanyama plays. I think he was capable of moving in that way. But of course, basketball was played much differently back in the early 80s when Ralph Sampson was playing, as opposed to how the game is played today. And so it's interesting to see how the game has evolved. And, you know, even hearing you talk earlier in the pod about the type of offense that you ran at Dayton, and you're running the Bobby Knight motion. And that was a lot of what we did when I was playing. And I've told people that I think in my entire career, as a college basketball player that I may have defended or participated in on offense five ball screens.
Yeah.
Maybe in my entire career.
Yeah.
And now that's basically what the entire game revolves around. And it wasn't even a part of the game that probably you or I played at the time. And so it's just interesting how the game has evolved and the way that it's taken on a new form, and it's going to continue to evolve and change as we go on. That's what makes it so great. And I think that's one of the things, Jack, that I love about the podcast is just getting to talk to people who have experienced the game in so many different ways, whether it's like yourself as a player at the high school, college, and then eventually the professional level, or coaches, and at all different levels. That's what's been really, really interesting to me. And
well, you again, know what's in, I want to just, you know, what's interesting, I was going to say to your comment is that what's really interesting as a kid, you know, all we played was pick and roll. I mean, in our 2-2 games and 3-3 games, right, in the neighborhoods, I mean, I was really good at pick and roll. I knew how to do that. I knew how to, you know, to fade. I knew how, I mean, but then when I got to kind of to college and in high school, it became much more about pass and pick away. So we lost all of those skills. And now it's back in the NBA. I mean, everybody's doing pick and roll everywhere, right?
Yeah.
So it's maybe back to the purity. Even they're doing the kind of the Harlem Globetrotter weave. I mean, that's kind of embedded in a lot of offenses.
Yeah, it's funny. My son's AAU team, we run that weave constantly, you know, and just keep trying to break down the defense and get closer and closer and closer to the basket till eventually something breaks free. And yeah, you think about that, it's old school basketball and yet just kind of a new modern twist. And I think, again, that's what makes the game so great is that it continues to evolve and it gives all of us who love it just a way to continue to appreciate what basketball has done for all of us. And again, Jack, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to join us tonight. I'm thankful to Tim Gallagher, as always, for connecting us with people who, like yourself, who have influenced him, but also people who just have great stories to tell. And again, thank you for being a part of it. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.